Okay, for the second panel, we have Suzanne Patti, Vice President of Regulatory and Patient Affairs, Cystic Fibrosis Foundation, with Dr. Michael Boyle, Director of the Johns Hopkins Adult Cystic Fibrosis Program, Barbara Boyle, National Executive Director and CEO, Huntington's Disease Society of America, and Pat Furlong, President of the Parent Project for Multiple Dystrophy. And before you actually start, let me do another technology check. Can you hear me better in the back now? That's good? Okay. All right. So let's roll.
Thank you, Commissioner Astu. I'm Suzanne Patti with the Cystic Fibrosis Foundation. We're very pleased to be here today. This is a very important issue for our people in our community with cystic fibrosis. I'd like to turn it over now to Dr. Michael Boyle. Before I do so, I wanted to mention that I have cystic fibrosis, as well as diabetes, which is related to cystic fibrosis. I'm fortunate to be able to work full time, but only because of a lot of the medical care that's gone on prior to that.
All right, well, thank you very much for the invitation today. My background is I run the Adult Cystic Fibrosis Clinic at Johns Hopkins, which is one of the largest adult CF programs in the country. We care for about 200 adults with CF. I just want to start by saying thank you for being such an important part of our program, even though you're here in D.C. Certainly, it makes possible support for a good number of our patients. You know, if you look nationally at the Cystic Fibrosis Registry National Database, about 40 to 50% of individuals with CF have benefits. And just backing up a little bit, a quick reminder about what cystic fibrosis is, although probably fairly familiar with it already. Cystic fibrosis affects about 30,000 individuals in the United States. It's one of the most common lethal autosomal recessive disorder in Caucasians in the United States. That it's caused by a group of mutations, not a single mutation, actually about 1,500 different mutations, which can lead to dysfunction of the cystic fibrosis protein, that protein which lines most of the lumens of our body and controls a lot of the salt and water balance there. And I think one of the key things to remember about cystic fibrosis is it's a multi-system disorder. I mean, it's very easy to focus in on the lung part, because obviously that's the part that leads to a lot of the morbidity and mortality, but definitely a multi-system disorder. So not only do you have obstructive lung disease, but chronic lung infections and chronic sinusitis, even as opposed to other lung diseases where there are periods where you're well. Cystic fibrosis, you never clear that infection. It's always present in the lungs and sinuses. And that those are those chronic times are interspersed with exacerbations, which basically are pneumonia-like, with increased pulmonary symptoms, shortness of breath, increased cough and sputum. Along with the pulmonary problems, there's also pancreatic issues. So about 85 to 90% of individuals with cystic fibrosis have pancreatic insufficiency, meaning they need to take enzymes in order to digest their food. Even with taking those enzymes, they have a real problem with maintaining their weight, keeping their nutritional status adequate. And then as they get later in life, and when I say later in life, for CF, that means over the age of 18, they often have complications including diabetes, insulin-dependent diabetes, osteoporosis, as well as other complications such as cirrhosis in about 1 to 2% of patients. That the good news is, as you've probably heard, that there's increased survival in cystic fibrosis. If you look back or talk to families when they had kids that were diagnosed with CF in the 60s or late 50s, if it was in the 50s, they were often told they wouldn't live to see their 10th birthday. In the 60s, they were told they'd be lucky if they made it into their teens. The exciting part now is because of a lot of treatment improvement, we're up to a median predicted survival of about 36 years of age. But you know, it's a little bit misleading because our median population age is about 16 years of age. So it's still a pretty young group. That the good news is with some of the improvement in survival, it's becoming not just a pediatric disease anymore. That over the next decade, more than 50% of all individuals with CF will be adults. And like I say, I take care of nothing but adults. So that's the good news. The bad news is that the way we're getting there is there's a real burden of treatment. So a lot of our patients spend 2 to 3 hours a day doing medications to try to, you know, have some quality of life. Suzanne can speak to this.
what that typically looks like is a morning where they start off doing inhaled mucolytics, spending 10 or 15 minutes inhaling a medicine to break up mucus, followed by another 20 minutes to half an hour using airway clearance techniques, either a vest or there's other techniques that are available to try to clear out mucus, followed by another 20 minutes to 30 minutes of inhaling antibiotics. Throughout the day, they're taking enzymes with each meal, trying to eat 5 or 6 times a day to try to maintain their weight, and then repeat that whole process at night. And as a matter of fact, I was talking to Suzanne that had written an article recently that was entitled "So Many Drugs, So Little Time," which was the future of adult CF care. Which is the great news is they're living, you know, our patients are living longer, but there's a real burden of care. And the challenging part is even when doing that, that it's sort of on average, maybe 2 times a year, they end up needing to do courses of IV antibiotics for 2 to 3 weeks because of these exacerbations. That certainly leads to difficulties with working, being able to function normally. And that's not even really mentioning a lot of the energy and problems that are leading up to the time that they're sick and around the time they're doing medication. So that was a maybe not so short recap of all the things that are going on in terms of the medical part of CF. But I think one of the things, just from my experience, that I wanted to stress today is it's easy to focus on the FEV1 part because, you know, we think of cystic fibrosis as a lung disease, and we think, oh, I know that. It's an obstructive lung disease. I look at the FEV1 and can tell what's going on. And that couldn't be further from the truth. It's easy when the FEV1's low, but the truth is there's a lot going on before then. And unfortunately, some of our patients have been in a situation where they've had to make a choice between trying to work or actually taking care of themselves. And so I think we just want to make sure, and Suzanne's going to talk about this some, that we address not only the end stage, yes, your FEV1's horrible, you need a lung transplant, but also those years right before that when there's a real burden of care that makes it hard for them to work.
Thanks, Dr. Boyle. So we wanted to touch on the listings specifically. We focused primarily on the respiratory listings. We did participate recently in the review process and the comment period to advise people on the respiratory listings. The first listing, Part A, addresses the FEV1, and we estimate that someone would have to be at about a 45% of lung function level for their FEV1 to be clearly disabled according to the listing. But there's also a separate Part B and a Part C. Part B asks how many physician interventions you've had in the last year. I think you have to have more than two in the last 6 months. We wanted to talk about a physician intervention as opposed to a hospitalization, since technology is changing and not everyone is hospitalized, instead of you getting home intravenous care as well. And then, as Dr. Boyle mentioned, we have under C, the use of inhaled antimicrobial medicine. There is antimicrobial is another way of doing an antibiotic, but because it's a lung disease, it's inhaled into the lungs directly. And people with CF, as they get more progressively sicker, often use an inhaled antimicrobial product to fight the chronic lung infection in their lungs. So just because they have to meet one of these three criteria in order to be considered disabled, and we're finding that many people do meet one of these three criteria, but are often being denied or being told they need to wait for a hearing. So, you want to touch on that?
Yeah, I was going to highlight just a common experience with some of our patients that what we usually say to them is, you know, if your FEV1 is below 30% or predicted, you'll be pretty quick turnaround if you apply for disability. But frequently, if their FEV1 doesn't meet that obvious criteria, we just tell them, you know what, you're going to have to wait. You realize that they're not going to get approval, despite the fact that when you look through their medical records, they really can't work. They are spending a couple times a year in the hospital or at home doing home IV antibiotics. They're doing a couple hours a day of treatment to try to maintain their health. And then we're telling them you need to do more of this because you're slipping. One case in particular that comes to mind is a 40-year-old woman who'd actually worked full-time for most of her life, but obviously was starting to decline, hadn't quite met the FEV1 criteria, but ended up spending 2 years waiting and really struggling to try to make ends meet and have to cut corners on her own care because she was in that period where, yes, she'd been doing lots of home IV antibiotics, obviously very sick, obviously slipping and spending a lot of time with that, but not meeting the FEV1 criteria, and so having to wait. In the comments there?
I think the main portion of this is that we've had cases primarily if someone meets the FEV1, they are...
Hold on. Okay. Just a second. We have people that are trying to listen in, and we're already having technology issues, so why don't we let the fire trucks go by. Okay. We'll also, before too long, have church bells, and so we'll take a pause during those as well.
Just make it.
Okay. Sounds good.
Well, wait, go ahead.
Okay. Often people who do meet the FEV1 part of the listings will be approved, but we do know of two cases currently pending where the individuals have been waiting now almost 2 years for hearings, and they do meet this part of the listings. And oftentimes when someone will get to their hearing... Okay. Oftentimes when they will get to the judge will look at the record and say, this person meets the listings, and it's as obvious, let's approve it. And that's just disheartening to the individual who's had to wait 2 years for that decision. So it doesn't always work that easily. And then it's more difficult if they don't meet the FEV1 but do meet the other two, where someone might say, well, you still don't meet FEV1. And we're saying, it's not an additional test. It's separate, three separate tests. So to the extent that the listings could clarify that these three different tests are separate and they're not additive, as well as trying to give a better picture that somebody who has a chronic lung infection who meets perhaps taking inhaled antimicrobial medicine, that is an indication of their level of involvement of their disease and that they need to be considered and evaluated as disabled because they do meet the listings. So we have some recommendations for the system to change it. We think it would be helpful to include some sort of lay language that would provide some of this narrative that we're providing you with to explain what the disease is. And yes, it is variable, but because we have a really good education system and process with our care centers and with the care centers directly to the patients, we believe that over 90% of the patients who do apply for disability benefits are going to be found eligible immediately on the listings. But that's not how it's being done, unfortunately. We have developed some materials to educate the physicians and provide letters for the physicians to send to Social Security to actually document, based on the listings, how their listings are met in the medical records. And then, as Dr. Boyle said, he can tell someone to apply or not to apply based on his knowledge of the listings as well. So that's why we think it's a really high rate of applicants to apply. We also would hope that anybody who at Social Security Administration who may be considering denying an applicant, that they will consider consulting a physician, an expert with cystic fibrosis, because as you know today, it's rare diseases. There are only 30,000 patients in the country. We estimate an average of 700 applicants a year who have CF. So it's rare that an ALJ will see more than one case in even his entire career. We'd also like to emphasize that it's a multi-organ disease. We've been looking at the digestive system listings. Right now we think they're pretty severe, and we recommended in the compassionate allowance letter that if you meet a certain eligible level of body mass index that we think is too strict in the digestive listings, that it be considered to be a little bit more lenient. I think right now the digestive listings, just for children, not for adults, say you have to meet a 3% BMI or so. And that is almost when someone, we rarely see people these days who meet that, because we're really trying to keep health on patients. So we really don't want someone to get that sick because they can't recover, basically, and they're really not going to be able to recover from that. So we'd hope that Social Security would consider assigning experts to rare diseases, to CF specifically, so that people who have the knowledge at the administration can really look at these cases and be able to evaluate them more specifically to make sure they do meet the listings. So that's our main application. Did you want to stress anything?
I mean, a couple other suggestions later on for specific things. I was getting the question from listening in the early time about other things you could ask during those hearings. You want to hear about those now? So some of those things, you know, certainly hospitalization is an easy one, and that's automatically asked about. But truthfully, the use of home IV antibiotics for weeks at a time is something that is becoming increasingly frequent. Some of that's driven by insurance issues, but certainly that would be something that would help get a feel for how much time those people are having to spend on their care and how sick they are. And that's something I don't think is currently always captured. the frequency that they're taking inhaled antibiotics, and also the use of tube feeds to maintain BMI. I think they're all signs of severity of illness and are other things that we may want to be collecting at the time of getting information about these individuals.
The adult respiratory listings don't really get into some of the digestive problems. It's much more clear in the listings for children. So we'd like to see that more clearly referenced as well.
You know, I think some of the education is actually for the physician side as well. I have to say we have numerous patients who are referred to us who obviously would benefit from being on disability, but have been told not until it's time to, not until you're ready for a lung transplant, until your lung disease is end stage. So that's, I think, one of the main things is trying to increase that understanding, not only for people hearing the cases, but for us to be able to know who to refer. And then I guess the last part is my understanding right now is the listings speak about heart-lung transplantation. And just on a medical side, we rarely do heart-lung transplantation anymore just because it uses up more organs than we need to. And that for cystic fibrosis, we almost always do lung transplantation alone. So changing that listing would be important.
I think that's all. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Barbara?
Hi. My name is Barbara Boyle. I'm the CEO of the Huntington's Disease Society, and I'm here with Dr. Andrew Fagan, who's director of our center at North Shore Hospital, and he is the professor of neurology at North Shore at New York, a university school of medicine. We would like to personally thank you for the opportunity to speak on this issue. And we greatly appreciate you looking at better ways to serve the rare disease community, which we believe is very, very important. I want to give you a little background on what Huntington's disease is. Huntington's disease is a fatal hereditary brain disease that slowly robs the affected individual of his ability to walk, talk, reason, and act socially. There are over 30,000 Americans today that have HD, and another 200,000 that are at risk for inheriting this disease. HD strikes in midlife, between the ages of 30 and 50, when an individual should be most productive, and it interferes with this individual's ability to care for his family and to work to provide for that family. The disease takes from 10 to 20 years to progress to the end stage, at which time a person succumbs to the complications associated with HD. HD is caused by a single defect in a single gene on a single chromosome. Those who inherit this defective form of the gene will at some point develop Huntington's disease, and they can pass it on to each of their children. Though the gene that causes HD was found in 1993, there still remains no effective treatment and no cure. Treatment is symptomatic and very limited. And because HD strikes so early in life, many medical and social services are not available for the people with HD and their families. HDSA, that I represent, was founded in 1967. Shortly after Woody Guthrie lost his battle with Huntington's disease. His wife Marjorie gathered families from around the United States, and during the years, 16 years that she lived until her death in 1993, she worked to obtain funding for HD and frankly family services that were non-existent at that time. Through her efforts, we've become the only HD organization in the United States that's dedicated to both the care and cure of our families with Huntington's disease. HDSA funds an array of family services and educational programs. We provide access to social workers, community-based resources, and referrals. We have 21 designated medical facilities that have expertise in Huntington's disease. And the social service workers at our centers frequently work with the families to complete the SSDI application, and our neurologists frequently are called upon to complete the medical evaluation. But there are only 21, and we have patients all across the United States. Our experience under ordinary circumstances is that our families report they can wait up to a year or more before their application is reviewed. And many are individuals, families, social workers, and medical professions have reported a variety of difficulties in receiving a determination of eligibility for SSDI benefits due to the general unfamiliarity with HD on the part of SSA educators or physicians assigned to review the case. At present, there exists within the system a lack of sufficient accurate medical information for evaluation of Huntington's disease. Though the cognitive and psychiatric symptoms usually precede physical symptoms, over 50% of our patients have psychiatric and cognitive symptoms before the physical or chorea even occurs, and these are very disabling. The determination by the SSA examiners and physicians assigned to these cases relies substantially upon the presence of this movement disorder. The belief on the part of the Social Security caseworker that the applicant or his or her symptoms will improve with treatment exists. The patient's lack of insight, which is a symptom of the disease itself, about the progression of the disease, results that the affected individual is incapable of giving an accurate assessment of his or her condition to the caseworker. And the biggest common practice of our patients is that they downplay reality and they downplay the extent of their condition. Difficulty in pinpointing exactly when a person with a neurodegenerative disease first comes disabled exists. And I can supply countless examples of denials and hardships due to the presence of only the psychiatric and cognitive symptoms. This leads to family abuse, sense of outbursts, severe depression, mood changes, and frankly, job loss. So now I'd like to turn it over to Dr. Andrew Fagan, who will talk about our centers and what we would like to see done. Thank you.
Thank you, Barbara. So, and thank you to the Social Security Administration for holding these hearings and the opportunity to present Huntington's disease as a disease that should be allowed under compassionate allowances. My name is Andy Fagan. I'm the director of the HDSA Center of Excellence at North Shore Hospital on Long Island. The HDSA, in their wisdom, established these centers of excellence to provide multidisciplinary care to patients and families with Huntington's disease, because Huntington's disease is not just Huntington's chorea, as it used to be called. Huntington's disease is a, as Barbara mentioned, a multifaceted disease and pervasive disease that affects all aspects of a person's functioning, from their social functioning to their motor functioning to their psychological functioning, their cognitive functioning. Of course, all of those things impact their ability to work. So the centers of excellence not only have a neurologist like myself, but we have psychiatrists and social workers and nutritionists and physical therapists and neuropsychologists. But despite all of this, Huntington's disease remains an inexorably progressive, devastating disease that produces significant disability even very early in its course. It is worth just reiterating something Barbara said, which is that there are no FDA-approved treatments for the indication of Huntington's disease to this day. We have medications to treat aspects of the disease, but really, I would agree with the term that Barbara used, limited, in the sense that depression is a common feature of Huntington's disease. It was described by George Huntington in the 19th century. And suicide is a common feature of the disease. It's an organic manifestation of the disease. And we do use antidepressants with some success, but this is obviously something that is really just almost, I wouldn't say it's a side issue, but it's it doesn't impact this inexorable progression of the disease. I would also reiterate that I have had many patients. I take care of about 200 patients with Huntington's disease. And I've been taking care of patients with Huntington's disease for about 15 years. I've seen many patients who have applied for disability benefits and had them turned down. In my opinion, actually, the diagnosis of Huntington's disease should be an easy case. This is a truly devastating disease that even early on causes major disability in a person's functioning. And again, to emphasize, really not just their motor function. I think one of the major reasons that people are turned down is that is the emphasis on motor disability. And Huntington's disease used to be called Huntington's chorea. I think if you see somebody with Huntington's disease, the thing that strikes you is their motor problem, their chorea. But from the perspective of people who take care of patients with Huntington's disease, the chorea and the motor problems, although they are real and people ultimately develop problems with walking and ambulation and end up bedbound, the major cause of disability in the early part of Huntington's disease is the cognitive, the dementia and the psychiatric disturbances. Could be as subtle as personality change to as severe as frank psychosis with hallucinations, paranoia, delusions. And that's really the major cause of disability, and we really don't have good treatment for it. Somebody who carries the diagnosis of Huntington's disease, the clinical diagnosis of Huntington's disease, is claiming disability, in my opinion, should meet the criteria, should be eligible for disability. Having said that, I do want to talk about the issue of biomarkers and the issue about how diagnosis of Huntington's disease is made. I do research with imaging, PET imaging and MRI in Huntington's disease. Barbara mentioned that Huntington's disease is an autosomal dominant disorder, so that every child of an affected individual has a 50-50 chance of inheriting the gene and getting the disease. It's 100% penetrant. The average person with Huntington's disease gets the disease when they're about 30 to 40, and then lives with the disease for 10 to 20 years. So most people with adult onset Huntington's disease function normally, go to school, you know, have professions, and then develop this devastating degenerative disease. We know from imaging studies, actually, that at the day that a person gets diagnosed, that is, they meet some, they cross some threshold of signs and symptoms that a doctor looking at them says, you now have clinical Huntington's disease. They have had a degenerative disease for many years. We know that from imaging studies looking at dopamine receptors, and imaging studies using MRI volumetrics. So people have significant disability even the day they get the diagnosis. The obvious biomarker I think that people think about when you think about an autosomal dominant disorder would be the genetic test. It's a commercially available genetic test. You can send someone's blood sample and get a genetic test that shows that they have the gene for Huntington's disease. This may sound like an obvious point, but I think for people who don't see genetic disorders very often, this may not be so obvious, that having the gene mutation for Huntington's disease is not the same thing as having the disease. And I would not claim that everybody who has the gene mutation for Huntington's disease actually meets the criteria for requiring disability, nor would the patients themselves, actually. Most people who have the gene mutation for Huntington's disease are, you know, live totally normally. As I said already, I've had a patient who was a commercial airline pilot. I have several patients who were doctors, who go on and achieved a high functioning in society and then develop these degenerative diseases. They, of course, had the mutation early on. They obviously were not disabled when they had the mutation. The thing that defines the disability, in my opinion, is the clinical diagnosis of Huntington's disease. If you have reached the point where your signs and symptoms are enough for a doctor to diagnose you with Huntington's disease, and you are applying for disability, I don't think anyone would argue with your eligibility at that point. I want to reiterate one other point that Barbara made, which is that people often deny their signs and symptoms. So that is a common feature of Huntington's disease. I think it's, an organic feature of the disease, but it's also a psychosocial aspect of the disease. Many of these people have grown up with a parent with Huntington's disease, an aunt and uncle with Huntington's disease, a brother or sister with Huntington's disease, and they've seen what it has done to them in terms of their behavior, in terms of their appearance, motor appearance with chorea. And it shouldn't be, but it causes shame and embarrassment. And they say to themselves, I will never look like that. And their reaction when they do start to look like that is, I don't look like that. And that can also have a major impact. I would say it actually, as far as disability is concerned, it's a positive impact in the sense that people will work until they're absolutely told they can no longer work, basically. I've never seen a patient inappropriately make a request for disability with Huntington's disease. It's always the opposite, that people are obviously disabled and still trying to maintain their work, basically. So I'll stop there.
All right. I'd just like to say that we have centers of excellence around the United States, 21 of them, that are that have directors with this knowledge of Huntington's disease. And we would like to offer to the Social Security Administration information on how we could work with your facilities out there to determine and move this diagnosis process through for a positive ending. What we did do is we left a booklet for you and four members of your team, so that has the listing of all of our centers. And we would like to be able to offer our assistance and offer our knowledge to be able to take this process through, so that our families don't end up getting lost in a system for a year or two. And I'd like to leave you with a message from one of our family, one of the mothers of one of the people who are dealing with Huntington's. She says, the signs most considered softer signs are minor movements such as tapping of the feet and shrugging of the shoulders, the beginning of chorea, but not the emotional problems, which are the very first signs of Huntington's disease, and those not recognized by most doctors across the United States. Those that make it nearly impossible to live with our family members affected by HD and cause loss of jobs, divorces, loss of our friendships and social interactions. So I thank you very much.
Thank you. Yeah, we're gonna hold off our questions.
Thank you very much. From Paragraphic Muscular Dystrophy, and because that's a mouthful to say, I like to just refer to us as PPMD. We focus on Duchenne Muscular Dystrophy. Our mission is to improve the treatment, quality of life, and long-term outlook for all individuals affected by Duchenne Muscular Dystrophy through research, advocacy, education, and compassion. I'm testifying on behalf of those families, but I do have personal experience in that my two sons were diagnosed with Duchenne Muscular Dystrophy. I am the de novo mutation in my family, and my two boys were diagnosed at the ages of 4 and 6 in 1984 and dead by the time they were 15 and 17. So I appreciate the opportunity because we're thankfully seeing an era where this one disease, once 100% fatal before the age of 20, is now moving into an area where the boys are living longer lives and they want them to be quite productive. So there are several key points I'd like to make in my testimony today. One is that there is confusion on the part of what programs to apply for and when on our on behalf of our families. There's a lack of information, knowledge, and categorization of these rare conditions within the systems and with those processing the claims. A lack of knowledge within a given disease-specific community related to what the programs might include, and concern that SSA programs discourage independence. I think that this term progressive illness is very nebulous because people talk about Duchenne muscular dystrophy and the muscular dystrophies as progressive diseases, but what does that mean in terms of progression? And it would be very useful if we had some sort of scale of progression, because often the needs and services that are required at a certain time are really going to change, and really we could predict that they will change and what they will change to over time. The exact time frame of those changes is more unpredictable. Muscular dystrophy is a broad term that refers to a number of primary diseases of muscle. They include the dystrophinopathies, which are Duchenne and Becker, myotonic muscular dystrophy, distal myopathies, Emily Dreifuss, facioscapulohumeral dystrophy, oculopharyngeal, and limb-girdle muscular dystrophies, which are a part of the dystrophinopathy group. Many aspects of the diseases are not understood, and these treatments are either unavailable or minimally effective. The age and onset and severity of the disease is highly variable. You just need to mention Duchenne muscular dystrophy, and you'll be responded to by either, oh yes, I have an aunt or an uncle with MS, or I've never heard of this disease. Most people ask about it, but once you see a boy walk with this disease, you'll never forget the image of a child with a waddling gait and a child who's falling quite frequently. It's the world's most common and catastrophic form of genetic childhood disease. Duchenne represents 90% of all childhood onset muscular dystrophy cases and is characterized by rapidly progressive muscle weakness that results in impairment and weakness and often death in their 20s. 1 in 3,500 male children will be born with the disease, and about a third of them into families with no previous history of the disease.
The boys will lose their ability to walk in their teens. They will gradually lose the ability to move their arms in their late teens, and will have pulmonary and respiratory, cardiac, and sometimes cognitive problems along the way. So this is a multi-system disease. It affects everything these boys do, everything that they need to do over time. And just when they're developing the skills that they need to function, these skills slowly melt away. And so they're left usually largely dependent on a wheelchair, certainly by the age of 15, and unable to move their arms in their late teens, with cardiac and respiratory needs as well, often ventilation during the day and certainly during the evening. Individuals who apply for benefits for a child diagnosed with Duchenne muscular dystrophy are often applying for Medicaid or Medicaid waiver program through their local Department of Health, Family, and Human Services. Many of these families are unaware of both programs, and many have no knowledge whatsoever. The application process required in most states uses the same guidelines to meet the criteria for being disabled, and this results in confusion for families, as often they are unaware of the requirements to qualify as disabled, and it's often based on income limits. In some states, approval is granted within 2 to 4 months, while in other states, the approval process can be quite long. Long waits are the results of many factors, to include the family's unfamiliarity with the process. These families often fail to provide the necessary materials and have difficulty obtaining supportive medical documentation to include an appropriate clinical diagnosis. Clinical diagnosis and certainly genetic diagnosis is now easily available to these families. Families are often unable to provide sufficient documentation to fulfill the criteria for disabled. There is sometimes a significant difference of opinion and lack of evidence in order to determine what is medical necessity or what is educational necessity. Individuals with catastrophic disabling diagnosis want and deserve to be independent, and developing systems that provide benefit while encouraging their independence is essential. Individuals who are able to work, even part-time, should not be denied benefits. Thus, this would discourage their independence. I really pulled some of our older patients, I never know what to call them, if I call them old guys or young guys or certainly adults with Duchenne, and I asked them what they would like me to tell you. There are several things that are really on their mind these days. One is, in all medical literature, this diagnosis is described as 100% fatal. They relate this as people processing claims, people having knowledge of the disease, to someone with a gun to their head and someone ready to pull the trigger, when actually, they're in their terms, they'll tell me, it's hard to die well over 20 years, so let's stop calling the disease fatal and let's have a definition of terms that clearly reflects the disabling condition as opposed to a fatal condition. They would like a scale for rates of progression, because often they'll apply for needs and these needs change over time and change in some boys quite quickly. They think there should be a tutorial for applicants, especially as they grow older and they are adults and want to be independent. They would like to know how to apply, what to apply for, what they might ask for, what they might not ask for, might not be able to apply for. These young men are really interested with use of technology to become independent. So they really feel like they're discouraged from being independent, because if they receive benefits, that they can't be a wage earner, and they're not often able to really earn sufficient wages to cover all of their needs. So they get into this dilemma of the sort of chicken and egg. If they work and become productive as they want to be, they lose benefits, and they can't possibly work long enough to have a significant wage to cover their benefits. So their really final word was to encourage you to develop a mechanism by which they can maintain independence for as long as possible, and they can be productive individuals with using technology, at the same time to be able, once that need is changed, to receive their benefits once again, or to continue their benefits along the way. Thank you.
Thank you. Let me start with a couple questions on Huntington's. So, typically, medical advances make our work easier rather than harder. It may, in the case of Huntington's, make it a little bit harder, because I think if this were 1965, usually by the time someone was definitively diagnosed, they would have progressed fairly far and wouldn't be too much question that they would be disabled under our standards. And I know that misdiagnosis was very common for a long time. Now, where an increasing number of people know, you know, at a very early age, what they're likely to be facing, we have to figure out where to, under the statute, we have to figure out the appropriate place to draw the line, because if the disease is going to start making a substantial impact sometime between the age of 30 and 45, the statute doesn't allow us to give benefits at age 25. So we need to figure out sort of how does this draw that line. And I think as long as we can draw that line effectively, it strikes me that in the case of this particular disease, most aggressive is fairly easy, because I think you don't have a range of severity and that type of thing. Can you talk to me a little bit more, Dr. Fagan, about sort of what do you use clinically to make a definitive diagnosis that someone really is at that point symptomatic and starting actual progression?
Yeah, so I wish I could say that there's a total score on some scale, that above that score somebody gets a diagnosis with Huntington's disease, and below that score somebody does not get a diagnosis of Huntington's disease. Unfortunately, that is not the case. There is no consensus about what degree of combination of motor, cognitive, and psychiatric signs and symptoms you have to have in order to achieve a diagnosis of Huntington's disease. And probably every, even among Huntington's disease experts, there's some variability in the people who are in that kind of few years of period where they're hovering between, well, would you call them having Huntington's disease, or you say that they're not quite there yet. Some doctors would say, I'm going to call that person Huntington's disease, and others would not. There is a point, though, and it's not well defined, unfortunately, at this point, where everybody would say that person has Huntington's disease. And I guess I would say, even though that is not an extremely well-defined point, that is the point when people should be eligible for disability. I'm not sure that, I would say I am sure that no consensus has been reached on exactly when that point is, but I do think that one aspect of it, I guess this is not something that is necessarily reliable, but is, I think that well, let me just take a step back. I do think there are a lot of people who do have the diagnosis missed for a long period of time, and when they do come to one of the centers or they go to somebody who has some experience with Huntington's disease, the cat's already out of the bag, and they clearly are at that level you were talking about where they are disabled. I do think for people like you're describing who know they're at risk and are going to an experienced center and they're being scrutinized longitudinally, every 6 months. Do they have eye movement abnormalities? Do they have other things? Do they, extensive neuropsych testing? There is a gray zone. I have to agree, and that's, I don't know if I have an answer to that, but I do think that that's a brief period for people with Huntington's disease, and then they go into this phase where there nobody would argue about it.
As we figure out where to draw lines, does age help us at all? I mean, is the natural history sufficiently consistent that you could say with a fair degree of confidence that the disease doesn't really, is not really symptomatic before age 30, or is there enough variation in the population that we couldn't say that?
Yeah, I would say that there's enough variation that you can't really say that. Having said that, there are statistical models based on the mutation, the CAG repeat, the triplicate repeat, which is what causes the Huntington's disease, that based on a person's age and CAG repeat length, you can predict within some range of probability when they are going to start showing signs of Huntington's disease that would meet a diagnosis of Huntington's. That's based on thousands of patients who have been diagnosed and knowing their CAG repeat length and their age at the time that they were diagnosed, and then creating essentially life tables based, and that's been published actually, life tables based on CAG repeat length and age at any given time in life, and probability of showing signs by a signs sufficient to diagnose Huntington's disease by a given age. So there is information out there. The problem is, it's a long-winded answer to say that there's a lot of variability around that. There are juvenile onset cases of Huntington's disease. The earliest reported case was the age of 2, and so the latest is in their 80s, so it is unfortunately very variable. The juvenile onset cases are, as you might guess from what I just said, are the cases that are associated with these very long CAG repeat expansions. So,
I mean, I think, the general principle that, this is a disease that we ought to be giving accelerated condition. I mean, I don't have any disagreement with that at all. I think the question for us is just, you know, how to draw the line in an efficient and a fair way that's consistent with the statute. So any guidance based on clinical experience at these centers of excellence or anything else you can do to help us figure out how to draw that line in, you know, what makes, in a way that makes the most sense consistent with the statute, that would be greatly appreciated for us, I think.
I think the interesting thing is that 10%, a maximum of 10% of all families at risk for Huntington even go and get the genetic test taken. So they live on the line that they're not going to get this disease. And I have to tell you that most of the times when they go to the center, we have an expert, a neurologist, who understands Huntington's. And when they give them a clinical diagnosis of Huntington's, they are well into Huntington's disease. And it may not be the chorea, but it is abuse in the family. It's paranoia and sitting in a room, never leaving that room for 4 and 5 and 6 months. So I think if we could work with you, with our centers of excellence, and with our group of neurologists who are very, very willing to work with every member and guide them on clinical diagnosis, then we would be certainly establishing a precedent for moving forward.
That's helpful. Let me move over to CF for a second. As we try to figure out obviously CF is very complicated because it is multi-system and there's a range in severity, and we can't just give out benefits to everybody with CF. We're just going to figure out the most intelligent way to draw lines. Is there any of the symptom, any of the other conditions that are associated with CF that in combination would be something that we ought to be looking at? For instance, is there anything when you've got, is it inflammation of the pancreas, is the...
So it's actually insufficiency. They tend not to have inflammation.
Insufficiency.
Yeah, it's insufficiency.
Are there a category of cases where the problem with the pancreas in combination with the other problems with CF,
could
you'd be able to look at that and say with a degree of confidence that you've got that, and that combination of impairments, you got to draw the line there, or is that still
confused? Unfortunately, not for pancreas, because about 85% to 90% of individuals are going to have pancreatic insufficiency, and there can be a spectrum of lung disease severity. So I hear what you're asking. You're trying to say, are there other things we can look at that help us tell us about the severity of what's going on? You know, unfortunately, the genotype, well, I didn't really mention this before, but genotype doesn't tell us, and that we know that about 50% of all individuals with CF have the same CF genotype, the Delta F508 homozygous mutations, and that there's a big spectrum of disease within that. So genotype tells us, yes, you have CF, but I don't think it helps answer that question. That to me, there are a couple of things. Poor nutrition can be one of the ones. Sometimes it's liver disease, although that's fairly rare. To me, the biggest thing that helps is trying to look at the frequency of illness and the burden of care, that, you know, how much time they're, because those are the things, in my experience, which have the biggest influence on whether or not that person can work. And I'll say up front, this is actually a flip side of where I'm usually telling our patients, hey, you can do this. Most of them want to work. I spend all my time saying, you know, you're going to live to be a little older, and so this is a little bit of the flip side. But the two ways that I think that we can measure that best in terms of burden is looking at the acceleration of their care. And so when you look at what medicines they're on, early on they tend to be on some mucolytics, things that break up mucus, and that doesn't really reflect severity of illness. But as they get added inhaled antibiotics, and they're doing that more frequently, every other month, twice a day, that's a real sign of the burden.
Is there one out there now, or are there multiple inhaled antibiotics? There
are two that are used, and another one which should be approved for use in the next year. And I think what's actually going to be seen is more and more, even more and more burden in terms of trying to do these medications. But I think that's actually a pretty good surrogate, because the recommendations for use of inhaled tobramycin usually is an FEV1 that's below 75% of predicted. And we tend to use it a little more infrequently until the patients are obviously showing more problems, and we keep adding on until they're doing it every other month. The other one is just the frequency that they're ill. So exacerbations, as judged by hospitalization is an easy one, but I think the home IV antibiotics is another one, that the number of times that they are requiring some other intervention. To me, those are the things which add up, which make it hard to
work. Yeah, I agree with that. Physician intervention, I'm always sort of dubious about that. That seems to be not a very good indicator. Yeah. But hospitalization or, to avoid IV, I think we'd all be a lot more comfortable with that.
Suzanne may have a comment, but I think that the way that things are written right now actually are they written well, because they actually do appreciate that there's not just a number that tells you how this person's doing.
I think sometimes it's how they're acted upon, because it's almost thought as more you have to have all of the above, rather than, even if your FEV1 is not horrendous and you're waiting lung transplant, there can be certainly a lot of other medical. You can be really sick. You can have an FEV1 of 70% and be in and out of the hospital, or be doing home IVs a couple times a year and struggling to function. And Suzanne,
let me ask a question for Suzanne. Sometimes it's both a good thing and a bad thing from dealing with us when you're multi-system. Sometimes it is confusing for people that have to work their way through the system, or the people that administer the system. But sometimes it does mean you have multiple bites at the apple. So we are, as you mentioned, we are working pretty hard to come out with some new the new respiratory listings, and we do appreciate your input into it. We have just come out with new digestive guidelines, which will be effective in just a couple weeks. And I just wanted to ask you if you had any input on section 508, which theoretically I think CF patients could use the new BMI index as a way of meeting the listings. Do you have maybe you want to look at this and supply it for the record, but do you have any thoughts on 508 and the digestive regs, whether we drew the line at the right place or for with regard to CF patients, or whether you're fairly happy with that?
I have to confess that we did not actually contribute to the digestive listings. We missed those. We were focusing on respiratory. But when we commented on the respiratory, we commented on the growth impairment for children and felt those were too severe. And then when we sent in the letter for compassionate allowance, we encouraged a specific BMI level being looked at as well. I think it was 10%. Now I'm going to pull out these numbers that I don't remember. I don't have my compassionate allowance letter in front of me, but I can certainly get back to you and specify what our recommendations are for the digestive BMI.
I think that would be helpful, and I think it probably also, it may be that we'll have something that's more helpful when we go through the respiratory listings, but at least this might be a helpful change for some people, so we should probably have some discussion about it, and it might also be helpful to do a little bit of outreach in the patient population and know this is another thing that they may be able to rely upon.
We appreciate the use of BMI, because we felt that was missing from the previous thing.
Thank you.
Good. For multiple dystrophy, I wondered if you could talk to me a little bit more, if you can, about for the patients that experience some difficulty going through our system. Do you have a sense that that's because of confusion about the disease, or do you have anything else that you can give me a little bit of a handle on as to, for those cases, why they're going off track?
I think some of these cases are going off the track for a couple reasons. One is this is a complex multi-system disorder. So in addition to progressive muscle function loss, some of these individuals have some issues related to respiratory and cognitive. So some of these children have learning disorders, and they run through the range of simple learning disorders or processing disorders through autism. So some of the boys have severe mental loss of function. So I think understanding where this child fits in the spectrum and what services that they might use or access is difficult for the parents to understand. So I think that that's been the difficulty, as well as there has been some differences in Medicaid and Medicaid waiver across states, where some patients are waiting for very short periods of time and other patients find that they're on a waiting list. So there's been a range of issues from these patients and parents.
The other question I wanted to ask, and my staff tends to cringe when I say things like this, but I go ahead anyway. I mean, it seems to me that a lot of the issues here are probably substantially simpler for children, and we have a related but different standard for children, but potentially more complex for the adult population for some of the reasons you started to touch upon. Could you talk to me a little bit more about sort of what percentage of the overall patients are adults and what their lives tend to look like, and what your sense is, how many of them try to work and what type of work and what the persistence of the work effort is, and just give me a little bit more touch and feel on that, because I think that would be helpful, at least to me.
Sure, I don't think we have accurate statistics today to tell you about how many are interested or willing to enter the workforce. I can say that because the disease is changing based on care and based on longer lives and cardioprotection, that these boys are living into their 20s and 30s. There are single cases now of young men going through college and on to having careers. But this is more and more becoming acceptable and routine for families, so that they're not assuming that this boy is going to die before 20 and not be able to live to be an adult. So I think that over time, then, we're seeing boys enter the workforce, but it's not as simple as entering the workforce and becoming a productive individual in terms of they have a loss of muscle function, so they need jobs and technology. Also, they need someone to help them, you know, do the activities of daily living, because they aren't capable or don't have the function to be able to take care of themselves in terms of toileting, activities of daily living related to combing your hair, transportation, and so on. So it's that dilemma where, you know, you'd like to fit them in a box that says that they can have a job and be productive, but in order to achieve that, they're going to need some services available to them, and then they don't have the endurance to work full-time, for instance. So there is that very difficult spot where if the loss of services is significant and the ability to work and generate an income sufficient to cover your needs is impossible. So it is a very dicey area that we're just seeing.
All right, I may have more questions. You know, I've got a tangle of notes here, but let me try not to hog the forum too much. David, do you have any questions?
Yeah, actually, I did. Okay. Mark, but the role of the Office of Rare Diseases is a little bit different than it's sort of a hybrid between what the advocates are doing in providing advice and what Social Security is doing in actually making regulations. So we're a little bit more involved in that, but there are other activities that we can do that ultimately can impact the decisions here. And so I had actually a question for Dr. Fagan regarding the sort of standardization of the diagnosis. You had indicated that it's fairly variable right now. But is the community ripe, is the field ripe for bringing together the people to make a standardized type of diagnosis that would then be the standard to which this could be reflected to Social Security?
The answer to that question is certainly yes. There are organizations of people, of like-minded people, interested in improving care and finding new therapies for Huntington's disease, like the Huntington Study Group, for example, that involves hundreds of people from, you know, people like myself from around the world, actually, that I think would be interested potentially in trying to do that. I think, though, that it would be a difficult task because there is this area in which where patients, you know, who have the gene for Huntington's disease enter, where they have very sorry, I've had this lingering cough for the last 6 weeks. Where they enter this kind of gray area. Where I think there's going to always be differences of opinion about how much weight to give to those things. But I'm glad you asked me the question, because I felt like after there was another point I wanted to make, actually, which is related to this issue, which is I mentioned that if you knew you were at risk for Huntington's disease and you were going to a center and being scrutinized every 6 months or every year, you know, that would present with this problem. But that represents a tiny fraction of people, I would say, who are at risk for Huntington's disease. The vast majority of people don't go to a doctor at all, actually, and they're not in this situation where they're being scrutinized. For the people who are doing that, it's actually not the people that enter this gray zone, or even people in the very earliest stages of an unequivocal diagnosis of Huntington's disease, that first year or two. Those people are not applying for disability, actually. And in my experience, they are not. It's the people who have crossed that threshold to the point where they clearly have signs of Huntington's disease are the ones who, and even they often are not applying. It's their families that are pushing them to do it. It's really, we're talking about a very small fraction of the people this discussion would even be relevant to, actually. The vast majority of people who are with Huntington's disease who are applying for disability are in that phase of the disease where nobody would argue about the diagnosis. So.
Ms. Furlong, do you have a sense if individuals would be
do they reach the hearing level in our process, or are they generally approved before it reaches the hearing level? In general, they are approved before it reaches the hearing level.
Some get to the hearing level.
And I believe with the other two conditions, they do actually reach the hearing level, like with Huntington's and fibrosis. But what's the sense? Once it's at the hearing level, are most of the cases approved? I'm sensing from Dr. Fagan, no.
Oh, no, I think it's yes, actually. But it's the frustration. We have some attestations in here from patients that I think reflect my experience, too, which are that people go through the application process, can drag on for a long period of time. They walk in for their hearing, and it's a no-brainer. You know, once the person actually sees the patient and talks to them for a couple of minutes, they realize that the person is disabled.
Is that your experience? Yes. And also, the question for me then is, are most people who have all of the conditions that you're representing here today, are most of them treated by specialists? No. That is the case in cystic fibrosis. Yes. We have 120 care centers around the country.
And then you're saying with Huntington's, no, generally jealous?
No. Mm-hmm. In our centers, we probably see about 5,000.
Right.
And there are 30,000 active HD patients. And the problem is that by the time they apply for disability, they really are into the system, into the process of having real psychological and emotional problems. If they have chorea, that's a different thing. Then they're willing to see that and admit it. But it's the psychological and the emotional problems that they have that have caused real damage. I mean, we have probably about 5% of our patients that go through the jail system before we're even able to see them, and we're able to work with them to get them on disability and to get them the kind of help that they need. So no.
Okay, but the people that actually go to the hearing, are they treated generally by a specialist?
Yeah, I would say so. A good part of them eventually at that point of the game, after they've been turned down a few times and then they end up going to the hearing, they've called us at our office, and we then try to get them to a center at that point of the game, yes. But sometimes it takes a year or two.
Sure, I understand. And Ms. Furlong, same thing. I mean, generally, if they get to the hearing level, they're treated by a specialist.
Most of the time,
they're diagnosed certainly by a specialist, but there is a certain percentage of the families that are lost to follow-up based on the message that there are a few interventions that would change the course of progression. So there is probably 25% of those patients that are then treated by their family doc or their pediatrician rather than the specialized center.
But the problem
when
I'm trying to pursue some is that we have two doctors on this panel, of course. It sounds like that some of these cases are getting to the hearing level. They get to the hearing level, and it's pretty automatic, is what I'm sensing. So what I'm trying to figure out here is what do we need to be asking the doctors differently? What do we need to be doing with the doctors early in the process so that they actually produce the information that we need so we can allow the case that's going to be allowed anyway? If either one or any of you actually, but your two doctors in particular, if you could respond to that, I'd certainly appreciate it. I mean, for Huntington's disease, I think the thing that I think would be important, actually, would be, because I mentioned, I think, earlier that there's an emphasis in Huntington, you know, Huntington's disease used to be called Huntington's chorea.
There's this kind of perception out there that this is a movement disorder. I am a movement disorder neurologist. I trained in movement disorders, and I take care of people with Huntington's disease. But there are Huntington's disease centers around the country that are run by psychiatrists, actually. And I think that there needs to be more... I think the information that should be requested and should be provided that might make the difference is cognitive and psychiatric information, that more in addition to the motor information. Yeah, for in the case of Huntington's disease, if that means just exam, or if it means things like neuropsychological testing, or if it means things like a DSM-4 diagnosis. I mean, all of those things I think could go into it.
So actually, I think there's two parts of the equations for CF. One part's on the hearing side, and one part's on the physician side. I think oftentimes our experience has been that the initial review is hesitant to look at much more than the FEV1, because everyone is so used to think of cystic fibrosis as a lung disease, and so they think, oh, it's almost a variation on COPD. I look at the FEV1, and if it's not that bad, they say, you know, you're not really that sick. Okay, we'll hear a little bit more of the details later. That's one of the reasons why I think we focus some on the idea of, hey, let's look at these other criteria as well. And I think one of the things that might help clarify that would be perhaps providing a few more practical examples of what these things mean in terms of the criteria. And then also some is on the physician side too, and that some of that same issue with thinking, oh, it's all about FEV1. But one thing I'll think is that the Cystic Fibrosis Foundation has really done a good job of trying to educate CF specialists about this, and hopefully it'll be something that'll be improving. I just want to make sure that once the physicians get with the program and are making sure they're supplying the right things, that there's also the understanding on the other side of the table. And so specific things to ask about are things like the frequency of inhaled antibiotics, the frequency of home IVs, not just, my sense is FEV1 and hospitalization sort of rule the day for most of the time. Any comments?
And I think just to make a comment about the muscular dystrophies, because they are a group of disorders,
I think there's confusion in what those each disorders represent, because there's age of onset is different, clinical progression is different. So to have really concise definitions of what those are and what the rates of progression are in each of those indications would be very useful, because then you could put those in a box that is not always going to be a clear, well-defined box, but at least a more understandable box.
That's a perfect setup to what I think may very well be our last question before the lunch break. Duchenne, I'm relatively familiar with, and one of the good things here is I think there is some reason for hope over the long run, because I've seen what a couple really interesting small companies are doing in the area, and I can't talk about it because I signed confidentiality agreements, but there's at least reason for hope, and that's great, and it's something I'm generally familiar with. Things are starting to change, and that's great. But I'll admit I'm really very ignorant about the other dystrophies and the other related diseases, and I wondered if you could help me a little bit to understand if we want to get a better handle on those. And I'm sure we've got people somewhere in the agency that do have a better handle, but at least for me, does your group represent those? Are you focused really on Duchenne, or do you represent all the other related diseases? Are there other groups and centers of medical excellence we ought to be aware of? I'm just trying to figure out, to the extent that there's a network in this whole disease area, I just want to make sure we don't miss anybody.
Yes, the Muscular Dystrophy Association represents the muscular dystrophies as a group, but there are also disease-specific groups like myotonic and limb-girdle muscular dystrophies under those. So there are disease-specific as well as the large umbrella organization, which is Muscular Dystrophy Association, and they certainly represent these diseases as well.
Okay, I think that we're pretty much done. I have to do an apology again today. We are in a close to a restaurant-free zone here. That may be changing with the renovation of the building that's diagonally across the street from us. But for now, it's the reason we've given a longer lunch break. Please, everybody, be especially careful today. We've had a little bit of rain and wet snow out there, so I'm sure it's very slippery. If any of you, there should be a restaurant guide in your packets, but if you don't have that, just go over to Diane Bronstein here on my right, and she'll be happy to help you out. Again, this is another terrific panel. This is extremely helpful to us, and we are exceptionally grateful for your contribution here today. So thank you.
Thank you.
Any